We're continuing our series today on a call to action, and so worked it out where we're going to take a look at a woman today, a woman of faith in the Bible, and we're going to the book of Esther. The book of Esther, one of the most fascinating books in the entire Bible. In the historical time period of Esther, there had been 50,000 Jews that had chosen to go back to Jerusalem with the permission of the king of Persia to go back and rebuild the temple. And yet there were Jews who chose not to go back, but rather to remain behind, and they became a part of the Persian culture. One of them in particular was a man by the name of Mordecai. He was living in the city of Susa, which was one of the four capitals of the Persian Empire, living there with his adopted relative, Hadassah, whom we also know as Esther. Now, living as a Jew in the middle of the Persian Empire wasn't easy. It carried some risk with it, risk of prejudice, even the risk of death. The king at the time in Persia was Xerxes. Or if you're reading maybe from the New American Standard, you might see the name Ahasuerus. He was a king that was famous for his extravagance and his recklessness. And we'll see that in a little bit. But let me give you some important pointers about the book of Esther. For one, this is the only book in the Bible where the name of God isn't mentioned. You will not find God's name in the book of Esther, and yet his presence can be felt in every chapter and in every verse. Secondly, the theme of the book of Esther is God. Even though he's not mentioned, he's the theme of the book, once again, rescuing his people, Israel. God is faithful to keep his promise of preserving a holy nation from which eventually will come who? Jesus, the Messiah, the Christ, his son. And a third thing is that I think that you'll be amazed at how the story of Esther relates to your story. I think the application is almost impossible to miss. So in chapter 1, let's begin reading in verse 1. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa, and in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all of his nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes, the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Wow. Xerxes reigned in Persia from 485 to 465 BC, so about a 20-year period. Again, his kingdom stretched from India to Kush, which was in Egypt, and to the Mediterranean Sea. And during the third year of his reign here, as we read, he threw this gigantic celebration to celebrate and showcase his vast wealth. It lasted 6 months. 180 days, at the end of which he held this huge banquet that lasted 7 more days. It was an all-you-can-eat, all-you-can-drink event. It was so big it had to be held outside in the king's enclosed garden, and he instructed his servants to give his guests all the wine they wanted in whatever way they wanted it. Xerxes was a party animal. He was a big drinker. Ken Idleman has been quoted as saying in a sermon that he's the kind of guy who says, 24 beers in a case, 24 hours in a day. Coincidence? I think not. Well, after this 187-day celebration, the king was drunk, you think? And as most people do under the influence, he did something stupid. People tend to do things like that they regret when they're totally inebriated, which is what Xerxes did. In verses 10 and 11, if you were to continue reading, he had his trophy wife, Queen Vashti, brought in to show her off. The real issue probably was that he wanted to brag about how great he was in having such a fine wife, but in verse 12, Queen Vashti wouldn't have anything to do with it. She wasn't going to be shown off like a piece of furniture or like a piece of meat or whatever. So that infuriated King Xerxes, and he burned with anger because she had pierced his pride, and he was pretty deflated about it. So in verses 13 through 15, he consults his lawyers and his wise men to find out what could be done to Queen Vashti. Well, they told him that she had not only wronged the king, but that every man in the kingdom was in jeopardy because their wives might attempt the same thing as Queen Vashti. So they encouraged him to issue a decree and have her banished from ever being in his presence again. And so when the king's edict was proclaimed, these wise men and lawyers thought that the women throughout the kingdom would then honor and respect their husbands. They would be put in their place. So in verse 22, the king issued the edict. Queen Vashti was banished, and every man was the king of his own castle again. And so you come to chapter 2, and we read a little bit about Queen Esther there. 4 years went by, and King Xerxes realized he didn't have a trophy wife anymore. Fact is, he didn't have a wife of any kind. And so he realized the stupidity of kicking such a beautiful queen out of the palace. He is sober at this point, and he's depressed, and he's lonely. And his advisors sense that, and they come up with an idea to cheer him up. They go to the king, and they share the idea of having a beauty pageant to find the king a new wife. He's the only judge. He gets his pick, and the king agreed to it. So they go and get this guy named Haggai in verse 2, and his job was to find the most beautiful women in the kingdom and bring them in for a series of beauty treatments, 12 months of beauty treatments, 6 months with oil and myrrh, 6 months with perfumes and cosmetics. How many of you women would want a year of beauty treatments? No takers, huh? Okay. Well, that's the way they were doing it. Well, verses 5 through 7, there's this Jewish man we've already mentioned living in the city of Susa from the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai. He had this relative he was raising basically as a daughter named Hadassah that he had brought up. We know her as Esther. And when the announcement of the king's order for the beauty contest went out, Esther was brought to the palace, and Haggai was immediately impressed with her. He assigned her 7 maids, gave orders for her to be given special treatment. Long story short, when the day came for Esther to be brought in to see the king, he was instantly smitten. He chose her, put a crown on her head, made her his new queen, and gave another banquet and proclaimed a national holiday. I mean, it's a phenomenal story. Kind of like a fairy tale, like Cinderella or Sleeping Beauty or something like that. And yet there's more going on here than just a good old-fashioned fairy tale romance. Who's behind the story? God is. He's not mentioned, but he's behind the story. Esther was now in the right place at the right time for a reason that extends all the way to you and me. Because this was no coincidence. There was no accident that a Jewish girl in exile found herself now wearing the crown of the Queen of Persia. At the end of chapter 2, Mordecai uncovers a plot that two of King Xerxes' officials were planning to assassinate him. He gets word to Esther, who warns the king. He finds out the story is true, and those two officials are executed. So we come to chapter 3, and we meet a guy by the name of Haman. Not long after the coronation of this new queen, Xerxes decided to promote one of his officials, this man named Haman. He was the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. I don't know if you remember King Agag from back in 1 Samuel 15. Saul was supposed to kill him and didn't. He was supposed to get rid of all the Amalekites and he didn't. And so Saul's failure to obey the Lord now has consequences all these years later because Haman is one of the descendants of those Amalekites. Remember last week when we mentioned, how much will my sin cost you? How much will your sin cost me? It always affects other people's. How many people's lives will be affected on down the road by what you do today? Well, we see that here. And so King Xerxes elevates Haman to the position of prime minister of Persia, a position that required everyone at the king's gate to kneel before Haman. But Mordecai, who visited the palace every day to check on Esther, refused to kneel before Haman. And when Haman saw that Mordecai wouldn't bow down to honor him, he became enraged, so much so that when he found out who Mordecai's people were, he decided to not only kill Mordecai, but also to kill everyone like him, all the Jews. So Haman here we see is a bona fide racist. He hated the Jewish people so much, he went to the king with a proposal to have all of them killed and even offered 10,000 talents of his own money, 10,000 talents of silver, to help get the job done. According to the Greek historian Herodotus, the annual income for the entire Persian Empire was only 15,000 talents. So he's offering a payoff for killing the Jews. That was two-thirds of the annual budget of the entire kingdom. His strategy was to have a special day set aside when it would be open season on all the Jewish people and anyone, anywhere could kill Jews on that day. Well, King Xerxes told him to keep his money, but he could do whatever he wanted to do with the Jews. And so the king signs the edict, which according to the laws of the Medes and Persians, once the king signed an edict, not even the king himself could repeal it. It stood. And the 13th day of the 12th month was chosen. Now from the Jews' point of view, you can't get much more discouraging news. It's over. The Jews are done. The law can't be repealed according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians. Have you ever faced an impossible situation like that? Have you ever had an insurmountable circumstance show up overnight? Have you ever felt you were in a place where there was no way out? No way over, no way under, there was just no way? Well, remember, God's in control. He's writing the story. Hebrews 13:5 says, "Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you." So in chapter 4, we get to talk more about Mordecai again. The plot to kill all the Jews reached the ears of Mordecai before Esther heard of it. Remember, she's the queen. She's also a Jew. But Mordecai had had her intentionally keep and conceal her nationality from the king. So the king had no idea that his queen was a Jew that was now under the edict that he had signed to have all the Jews killed. He didn't know that. Well, Mordecai sends a messenger to Esther with the whole story and with a copy of the edict. She reads it and sends word back to Mordecai, "There's nothing I can do. The king hasn't summoned me." Because in that day, unless you were summoned by the king, if you just walked into his presence without his summons, it was the death penalty. And he hadn't summoned her for 30 days, she said. And so then the most memorized verse in the book of Esther, chapter 4, verse 14, where part of Mordecai's reply is, "Who knows, Esther, but that you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Well, Esther told Mordecai to have all the Jews in the city of Susa to fast and pray for her for about 3 days. She would do the same. Then she said, "I'll go to the king, and if I perish, I perish." So she's willing to die for her people. So in chapter 5, on the third day, Esther goes in and stands in the inner court. And when the king saw her, he was pleased with her, extended his golden scepter, which meant that her life would be spared. The king told her he would grant her anything she wanted, up to half the kingdom. And she requested to have Haman come to a banquet that she would prepare. So the king had Haman brought at once, but the timing evidently didn't seem right. And Esther asked the king to have Haman come the next night, again to another banquet. And in the meantime, Haman continued to watch how Mordecai refused to bow before him, show any respect. So Haman had a gallows built 75 feet high in order to have Haman hanged on it. Chapter 6, the king couldn't sleep one night. He asked for the book that recorded the history of his reign to be brought in. And he reads it and finds out about a murder plot against him that had been discovered by a man named Mordecai, and asks what had been done to honor this man. Wonder why he couldn't sleep that night. Who's writing this story? Yeah. When he found out nothing had been done for Mordecai, he called for someone. It just so happened Haman had just walked into the palace to ask for the blessing of the king to execute Mordecai on the gallows he'd built. And the king asked Haman, "What should be done for the man the king has decided to honor?" Haman immediately thinks, "What? He's talking about me." So he gives this great big list of stuff that ought to be done. And the king says, "That's wonderful. Go at once and do that for Mordecai." Well, Haman did everything the king told him to do, rushed home then after that because he's furious and he's humiliated. He had no sooner made it home until the king's men come to get him for the banquet. Well, in chapter 7, the king asks Esther again, "What's your request? I'll give you up to half the kingdom." And she said, "Spare my people from being destroyed." And the king said, "Where is the man who dared to do such a thing?" And she points to Haman in verse 6 and said, "The adversary and enemy is this vile Haman." And he's terrified now, probably looking for a Persian rug to crawl under. But he got up in a rage, the king did, and left the room. Haman rushes over to Queen Esther to beg for his life. Some scholars think he tripped, and he fell on top of the queen just as the king is re-entering the room. And now he's seen enough. He thinks that Haman's trying to molest the queen. And the words had no sooner left the king's lips than his servants come in. They cover Haman's head and lead him away and hang him on the very gallows that he had constructed for Mordecai. And the end of the story, basically, is the king elevates Mordecai to second in command over the kingdom. And the Jews, even though the king cannot repeal the edict he had made, he issues a second edict that allows the Jews to defend themselves, which they did quite successfully. Now, that's the story of Esther in a nutshell. But the call to action, even though we don't have the name of God mentioned, you can see that Esther was placed in the kingdom for such a time as that. Let me give you 4 quick principles I've observed from the story of Esther. These won't be on the screen, but maybe you can jot them down if you'd like. Now, here's the first one. God has a special plan for your life. He has a special plan for your life. Esther was placed in a royal position, not by chance, but for a purpose. It reminds me of Proverbs 16:9. In his heart, a man plans his course, but the Lord determines his steps. And the Lord sure did in Esther's life. God did not make a mistake in the place where he has you today in your life. God hadn't made a mistake. I think we spend too long in our life trying to figure out where God wants us to be, or maybe wishing that we were somewhere else, instead of just allowing God to do something with our lives right where we are. God has a special plan for your life. Here's the second thing. Sometimes you'll have to go against common sense, against what others advise, even against what you want to do, in order to follow Esther's plan, or in order to follow God's plan, as he did for Esther. Esther would have to approach the king, something she didn't want to do. She didn't have permission. Could have meant certain death for her. It was against the law to approach the king, but Esther's response was, "If I perish, I perish." Sometimes God's will for your life will make perfect sense, but sometimes it won't. Sometimes you have to take risks for God. And the best things in life often come with the greatest risks. And the degree of difficulty is not an indication that God is not in it. In fact, the opposite might be closer to the truth, that he is in it with the greater risk. Here's the third thing. The time to follow God's plan is now. Right now. I still find that verse 14 in chapter 4 interesting. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you've come to royal position for such a time as this. The words of Mordecai. We usually focus on the very last part of that, for such a time as this. But did you notice the two words, and who knows? Who knows? That's a question. Evidently, they weren't sure. They knew she was in position as queen. She had the opportunity to see the king. They knew that God wanted to save the people. They knew for whatever reason Esther had been made aware of the plan, but they did not know for sure that that's what Esther was supposed to do. But they went without being 100% certain. Who knows? There's going to be times in your life when you've gathered all the information you can, you've prayed as well, and you've sought godly counsel, and whatever it is you're thinking about doing isn't something sinful, but there's something inside of you that's still not sure. You can sleep on it, you can fast and pray, like Esther did. She waited 3 days, but at some point, you just have to muster the courage to move forward without all the answers. So are you ready to step out and walk by faith? Don't be afraid to allow God to determine the outcome. Step out in faith. And here's the fourth thing. Trusting in God completely brings great rewards. In every province and in every city, wherever the edict of the king went, that the Jews could defend themselves, there was joy and gladness among the Jews, feasting and celebrating. Many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them. Esther saved a nation. Her obedience saved God's people from destruction. The reward for obedience was even better than expected. Esther went before the king, prepared for the worst case scenario. She got the very best. So many people became followers of God. The people were inspired by the faith of this one woman and this one man, and everything changed in that nation. And it will always prove profitable in the long run to obey God. Always will. When others see us living in radical obedience, obedience that makes no sense, they'll want some of what we have. And so the world around you is looking for answers. They're trying to figure out how to make life work. And we may not have all the answers, but we know about a God that does. So when was the last time you asked, God, What do you want to do through my life? You've brought me to such a time as this. What do you want me to do? Step out in faith. Let God direct your steps. And watch the marvelous things that God will accomplish through you. Happy Mother's Day. And we praise our faithful mothers today. We're going to stand and sing a hymn of decision. And if there are public decisions that you would like to make today, we encourage you to make those right now as we stand, as we sing.